We're at the end of another busy week on Radio 1. I'm Louise Herity. Welcome to Playback Daily. And from the do's and don'ts of wedding speeches to back to school lists, already here's just some of what's coming up.
Yes, and not just black cats, also things like black dogs or rabbits that are black. A lot of animals that are black often get left behind.
You've just taken this off the internet, you know? Mm. Like, you can't say this. Like, and like, some fellas like just don't even know there's a line.
We already lost a baby this year. I worked all through that, but I'm not in a position where I'm happy to risk the life of our baby for the sake of a few weeks of school.
We've been there for the heartfelt ones and the cringy ones, but what are the do's and don'ts when it comes to wedding speeches? Catherine Thomas, sitting in for Ray Darcy, spoke to Cormac Lally of Bespoke Wedding Speeches to find out.
How are you, Catherine? How are you getting on?
I'm good. So how did you get into this malarkey?
My baby brother was getting married in 2012 and my middle brother was the best man. And he asked me, would I write something for him? So we sat down with a box of my favourite beer and the stories just started flowing. And I said, man, there could be a poem in this. Would you do a poem? And he said, oh, I just do anything now at this stage just to have it over and done with. And
because he was terrified, so, was he?
He was terrified, man. And my brother is like so confident in every other aspect of his life. Mm. And he was just so nervous about this. And we wrote him a poem. I coached him on how to deliver it. And he got up the day of my brother's wedding and absolutely just brought the house down with it. And a guy came up to me at the bar an hour later and he asked me, would I do one of those for his brother's wedding? Was in 2 weeks. And I did one for him. And then a few days after that, someone rang me. They'd heard about it. And then a friend of mine, Lockie Hooper in Dotser in Tullamore, he made me a really, really good website. And he said, look, best of luck with it. I had done some work for him. And he said, look, I'll do you a website and see how it goes. And
the rest, as they say, is history.
And yeah.
And come here.
I've loved it ever since.
So, but you're an electrician by trade. Like, you're not a poet.
I am. Well, I was an electrician by trade. I came home in 2008, when the crash happened, and there wasn't a whole lot of electrical work going on. There was more poetry being written then than houses been wired during the crash time. And but I always loved writing. My mum was a writer. My dad was a great singer. My dad, you know, was great with his hands. And even now, I'm actually back ever since the pandemic happened, since the weddings kind of went went kind of bust. I've been back on the tools now for the last 4 or 5 months, and the weddings are starting to come back now. So I just said, look, I'm lucky that I had a trade to fall back on.
Yeah.
But for the last 7, 8 years, I've been full-time writing poetry and full-time writing traditional wedding speeches for people. That was my main source of income.
Okay. So come here. I mean, because people fear public speaking more than they fear dying. Like when those surveys are done, I mean, people have a genuine terror for it. So,
yes.
I mean, I don't envy anybody who has to get up, who's that uncomfortable. And you see it and my heart always goes out to them. But let's talk through the common mistakes, I suppose, that people make with wedding speeches. What are they?
Getting drunk.
Yeah.
Getting drunk, number one. Not preparing anything. They are the two worst things, you know. Copying stuff down from the internet and trying to pass it off as your own. We've been to enough weddings to know that we've heard all the jokes.
Mm.
We've heard all the kind of crude stories. We know that they're not true. We know that you haven't come up with this yourself. Originality is the best thing. And I say to my brides, my best men, to my grooms, be honest. Mm. You know, you have a story to tell.
Yeah, and everybody's story is individual and unique.
Yes.
So how do you, give us the steps, how do you go about starting to work with people? And particularly, I suppose, in recent times in the pandemic.
So, well, see, I've nearly always been online. I live in Tullamore. I'm originally from Tullamore and moved down to Skibbereen a few years ago. But I used to always meet people in McNamara's pub in Kilbeggan.
Right.
They had a little snug, like, so I was kind of like, if you drew a 2-hour circle anywhere around there, I just pick up people from Galway, from Dublin, and they used to barman used to say, like, oh, this is, you're coming to have your confession heard. You know, and they'd see my clients come in. And, but like, sorry, no, hang on one second.
Oh, God bless you.
Oh, pardon me.
You're all right. So how, like, what are the main steps that you go through with people then starting out to make sure the speech is good? Like steps 1 to 5?
Basically just sit down and I have a chat with them. So I do either over WhatsApp or over Skype. And I have a set interview there where basically I tell them it's kind of like making a sandwich. The very first step is the bread and butter. You know, that's your parents' names, brothers, sisters, where you're from, where you went to school. There's as much of that kind of information as you can, so we can kind of build up a picture of who you are. Then we start like with the meat of the sandwich. This is the, you know, basically your if you're a best man, it's like your first memory of this guy. You know, how did you meet each other earlier? What is the path of your friendship or the path of your family? You know, are you an older brother, younger brother? You know, what's your relationship? What are the things that make your friendship strong? What are the things that brought you together as friends? You know, was it football? Was it sport? Was it, you know, going to college? You know, and you try and you ask people, as you know, some people I say to me, "Oh, look, that's very personal. Or why would you be asking that?" And I tell them the reason is because if you want me to write something that's personal to you and that is honest and is heartfelt and is true, then this is stuff I need to know.
And I think that's where, I think that's, you've just hit the nail on the head there. I always, when I'm sitting at a wedding, honesty, you can, it just, it lifts the room. Whereas humour, and I think people feel under pressure to use humour or inappropriate, like the texts that are coming in here now, and they're all, you know, I saw one where the best man made a really dodgy joke about the groom's sex life when he was in his 20s. It's big no, so cringe.
There's no room.
Somebody else, make sure the best man stays off the drink. From experience, from my experience attending weddings, I've seen horrific slurred and incoherent speeches. The worst wedding speech I saw was when the speech consisted of thanking various people for coming. That obviously sounds like a lot of nerves, but it's the inappropriateness, I think, which some guys and girls confuse with humour. So I suppose you're a good buffer there in terms of people trying stuff out on you.
Yeah, and like, I mean, I would have heard it all, and people would kind of, you know, sometimes people would kind of send me on lists of stuff that they kind of want to incorporate in. Like, and I'm like, mate, you've just taken this off the internet, you know? Mm. Like, you can't say this. Like, and like, some fellas, like, just don't even know there's a line.
Mm. Mm.
You know, like, I'm like, that's a grand story to tell the boys down in the pub.
Yeah, not on their wedding day.
That's not a story that was meant for mass consumption.
Yeah.
On a mass scale. It's just, it's not. Like, there's a time and a place.
Yeah.
And
all right, Cormac, thank you so much. Sorry, I'm running out of time here. But listen, people can find you at bespokeweddingsspeeches.com. And that's it. Keep it honest, lads. Keep it real.
Some good advice there for sure. The arrest in Spain of Jerry the Monk Hutch made front page headlines this morning. Crime correspondent with The Star, Michael O'Toole, had the story for Áine Lawler on Morning Ireland.
It broke very late yesterday evening. We understand that, well, we do know that Gardaí have been liaising with international police forces since around April, looking for Mr. Hutch in relation to the investigation into the Regency Airport Hotel gun attack in February 2016, in which Keegan and associate David Byrne was murdered. As part of that investigation, my understanding is there was an intelligence-led operation by the Guardia Civil in Fuengirola, which is in on the Costa del Sol, and Mr. Hutch, who they, as I say, they have been international police forces have been looking for since April. He was arrested, so he's currently in custody in a Spanish police station on foot of a European arrest warrant issued by the Irish state in April, and the process will now begin, but it is likely to be several months before Mr. Hutch is brought back to Ireland.
How does that process unfold, the extradition process, over the next few months?
He is, the first thing that will happen is he will be brought to a Spanish court, and the process will be started. So the Irish authorities have to essentially apply for him to be extradited to Ireland in relation to that investigation. Now, Mr. Hutch does have the right to contest that extradition. If he doesn't contest the extradition, it could be maybe 3 weeks to a month before he is brought back. If, as is more likely, Gardaí would be of the view that, you know, he'd probably be a fool not to contest it at that stage in Spain. And if that does happen, it could be 6 or 7 months before the extradition is copper fast. Now, it is likely, you know, barring some procedural mistake, that the extradition will go ahead, but that will be up to the Spanish magistrates to decide. But it is usually a lengthy process. I've covered several extraditions from Spain and from Ireland, and when people fight it, it does take maybe up to 6 months.
And as you say, Gerry Hotch hasn't been in Ireland for many years. What's known about his life here and abroad?
He was last seen in Dublin at the end of February 2016 at the funeral of his brother Eddie, who was murdered as part of the Kenan Hutch feud. 18 people, 17 other people had been killed in that. He was escorted out of Ireland after the funeral. He got on a plane, and we do know that he has business interests and properties in Lanzarote in the Canaries, mainland Spain, Holland and Turkey, we believe. Now, we understand that he has been, as I said, Gardaí have been trying to find him for several months, but it is fair to say that the Kinahan cartel have been looking for him for probably since 2015. We do know that he survived a murder hit in Lanzarote in New Year's Day 2016 or late 2015. So the Kinahan gang have been looking for him. So he has effectively been a marked man by the Kinahans and has been moving around Europe trying to stay ahead of the Kinahan cartel. And, you know, he doesn't spend that too long a time in one place. He has been moving around trying to stay ahead of them.
And Gerry Hotch, of course, made a settlement with the Criminal Assets Bureau, didn't he, for more than £1.2 million?
Oh, that,
euros, yeah.
Yes, that was a long time ago. I think I was around, I remember covering that. I think that was 2000, 2001. Yes, he did. There was effectively a tax demand by the Criminal Assets Bureau. That's what they do. They tax, they put tax demands on people of interest. And Mr. Hutch, he brought the cash into a bank. He took it from a bank in Talbot Street, and he was photographed by undercover Gardaí at the time, I remember. So yes, he has, you know, there is a long history of interactions with Gardaí, I suppose, but this is quite a sensational turn in Mr. Hutch's life, but also in the Kinahan Hutch feud has been ongoing since September 2015, when his nephew Gary was murdered in Estepona, ironically about half an hour from where from Frangarola, where Mr. Hutch himself was arrested yesterday. So, you know, there have been plenty of twists and turns in this feud since then, but this is probably one of the more sensational ones.
And Gardaí, of course, have been working on this investigation for many years now.
Yes, I mean, it's been a very, very significant investigation. We know that one man, Patrick Hutch, Mr. Hutch's nephew, was initially charged with this murder before the Special Criminal Court, but after the sudden death of a senior investigator, that case effectively collapsed in Mr. Hutch. There was a nulli prosequi entered, I remember, so Patrick Hutch is now a free man and an innocent man. But four other men are currently before the Special Criminal Court. One is charged with murder and three are charged with offences connected to the murder of Mr. Byrne. They're next up in the Special Criminal Court, which is a non-jury court, on the 31st of September, and they will learn when their trial is to go ahead and and how long it will last. I anticipate that will be next year, and whatever happens with Mr. Hutch will probably be after that. So it has been a very long running investigation by the Gardaí, and it's not over. There are a significant amount of people of interest in this investigation, and Gardaí are still investigating it.
That was crime correspondent with the Irish Daily Star, Michael O'Toole, on Morning Ireland. Hard to believe we're already talking about back to school, and on today with Philip Boucher-Hayes, Jen Hogan, parent and columnist and mother of seven, had a look at some of the costs and concerns of parents ahead of the new school term.
If you had been with me yesterday, you might have actually been needed to administer CPR, as I almost choked at the amount of money that I was handing over. And I'm only halfway through an exercise to send one to secondary school for the first time that I think could top out at about €1,000.
Yeah, I mean, the cost of back to school, it's crippling. And it's the same conversation we're having every year. Every year we're highlighting how expensive it is, how unrealistic it is. Parents are getting into debt, taking loans, trying to manage the different costs. And they seem to be going up instead of going the other way. You know, we're still there with the crested uniforms. We're still there with the crested jackets, the things like that. The book lists are still going up. We're still using workbooks, which are such a shocking waste of money and a huge, huge cost. And now we've a lot of schools who are moving to the iPad. So for anyone who's starting in secondary school, that's a whole different ballgame altogether.
Let's just deal with them one by one. Have you ever heard a decent argument in favour of retaining the school crests on the jumpers and the jackets and the blazers and whatever else?
I mean, I know some schools like to have the crest there for identification. They like the ownership of their crest. But I don't think we need crested jumpers. It is possible, if that's something that they really want to do, that they want to hang on to their crest, we could get one that could be purchased and sewn on to a generic jumper, which would make uniforms so much more affordable for parents. But that's still not happening. So parents have to go to specific shops to buy the crested uniform pieces. And some of these jumpers, you're talking €50 plus. It really depends on the sizes that you're buying. And you know what kids are like. They're lost, torn. Anything can happen to them over the course of the year. One isn't enough to keep most people going.
It's not environmentally sustainable
either.
Which is the question that we should all be asking ourselves. And speaking of environmental sustainability, the books.
Yeah.
Why is it that somebody in the Department of Education hasn't banged the heads of all of the boards of governors of the schools and just said, no, I'm sorry, you're all signing up to a book rental scheme from now on?
You'd have to wonder, wouldn't you? I mean, still the cost of books is probably the biggest outlay for most parents as a standalone, because they're still huge costs. And the new additions mean that just because they had a book left over from an older sibling, perhaps can't be passed on, because now we have the latest edition, the workbooks with the younger years, they're all adding up. But what is happening, as I mentioned there a little while ago, the iPads as well. A lot of parents there are being asked to get the books as well. So we have double or triple waste here, because you may have those books from an older child, but they can't be used because you've taken the code from the original book to put it onto the iPad. You've got to go buy the hard copy all over again so that you get your code and you still have your hard copy.
I can understand the educational reasons for wanting them to be computer literate, but also wanting to keep on, you know, doing things with cursive writing and actual reading books and so on. There's good educational reasons for that. But there surely has to be, it's not a case of there surely has to be. We know there is another way of doing this. What is the resistance?
I really don't know, because it's certainly not parents who are in any way supportive of this. Most of them are totally outraged, can't understand why all schools aren't moving to a book rental scheme. There have been suggestions of, you know, having the hard copies in school where they're rented, renewing licences so they can be used where schools have moved to technology to learn. There are ways around it, but they're just not happening. And the ask continues, and the drain on parents' financial resources. You have people saying that they have no treats all year, no holiday, no anything, just to try to meet the cost of back to school, which of course go well beyond even the books, the likes of the after school activities and stuff, the things that we perhaps think of as optional. But you can't really leave your child out of certain things. I mean, they're helped with the development of social skills, motor skills, all those different things, teamwork if they're involved in sports or the arts, whatever it is that they love. So there are even the hidden costs perhaps that we don't think of when we're talking about back to school.
I have heard it said that the first year of secondary school is the most expensive, but as a mother of seven who's been through this a number of times now, is it the case that no, those costs just keep on replicating themselves year after year?
Yeah, no, they do. I mean, first year is definitely, I have a first year going in this year, and he will cost me the most, obviously, because he's going to need a brand new uniform. He is an iPad student, so we have that initial outlay too. He'll need that. He'll need a sports gear. We'll need to sign him up to new activities that are relative to his school. There'll be a different initial cost there, and I think most parents will find that, and then the books will hopefully do him through to the junior cert, save the odd edition. So there is that initial cost there. But no, I don't think, even going down through the primary school children, I don't see my own cost personally getting any less, even as the book rentals, and there are some within my own school, and within lots of schools there's partial book rentals
in national schools,
and there's either complete or partial in certain schools. But again, parents will say that they have these extras that keep coming up, you know, the photocopying, the contribution to arts and crafts materials, even though parents then are supplying their things too, that they're continuing to rise, so they're not necessarily feeling the benefit. But even where the books are coming in, there are additional costs coming in elsewhere.
And is there again another set of costs that are replicated as you transition from the junior cycle to the senior cycle?
Yeah, there are. Again, I've somebody going to 50 years. I can relate to literally everything, but there is actually, when you're changing books again, with new editions, so can't necessarily take books from older siblings who have perhaps gone before, but there is the books that will be needed for fifth and sixth year, fifth year being probably the most expensive. Often there's a uniform change as well at fifth year because they're going into the senior cycle of the school, so perhaps the jumper changes or the trousers change or the tie change, but it's frequent that you'll see a uniform change at that stage too.
There is no shame, is there? And I know that there are some people who do feel embarrassed about this, in ringing the families with older kids and saying, right, what clothes are you getting rid of?
Absolutely not. And you know something? It's so funny because I know, again, even from my own perspective, I would have parents contact me and say, I don't want to offend you, Jen, but I have some spare uniforms here. My son's finished in this school, or my daughter's finished.
Hand
you want
to
bring it on, because absolutely. And I, likewise, I will pass on to friends as well who have younger children coming up. It's a way to cut the cost, and kids lose things constantly. They're only back at school, a jumper's gone, a tracksuit's gone, tracksuit top is gone. So they lose things constantly. So absolutely, I don't think there's any shame. I hope that we've moved on from that. I don't think that it's necessarily seen kind of a shame. More maybe there's a worry of offending by offering. I think might be the bigger thing.
There could be nothing more pragmatic, but I have gotten that sense that some people would say, oh God, no, I'm never going to send my kids to school in somebody else's kids' clothes. That's just not... But
they'll come home with yogurt all over it anyway, so they can be brand new and crisp clean. They won't look like that at the end of the day.
Let's talk about the restrictions that are still going to be in place in schools. What are parents saying to you about it?
So there is, I asked parents what was on their minds ahead of the return to school, and obviously in September we'll be continuing with the restrictions that were there at the end of the year. And there are concerns about COVID and catching COVID, particularly in primary school age children where there'll be no vaccination yet, and there are worries there. But actually, one of the things that came up repeatedly was the masks for secondary school. Parents would like to see, or like a date where we will move towards an end of masks in secondary school. That came up an awful lot. They said that it was difficult for their students over the course of last year. It's hard for them to interact. It's particularly difficult for first years. They're trying to meet people, but it's a long day of wearing masks. And will we get to a stage where students won't be expected to wear masks in secondary school? That's certainly a question on a lot of their minds. The worry that it will be introduced for primary school, that is still very, very unpopular.
Is there any talk of a vaccine bonus there, where a child, obviously we're talking about secondary school, has been vaccinated and then becomes a close contact? Do we know yet how they're going to be treated?
We don't know yet, and that's the thing that everybody's wondering, and I suppose it would be really interesting to find out, particularly with the portal having opened for 12 to 15 year olds. If you are a close contact as a child and you are asymptomatic and you're vaccinated, will you have to isolate? That is something that's on parents' minds.
But the advice for adults at the moment is you don't need to do anything.
No, but we're wondering if the advice will be different in the school setting. So that would be seen as a big, actually parents even mentioned it to me, it would be a big attraction for parents in terms of getting their children vaccinated if they thought there was a vaccine bonus as such, because there are worries about the disruption to education again. The fear the schools will close again is real. I mean, it's still there. It's like the Leaving Cert dream for parents. That whole worry, it doesn't matter how much reassurance is given, there is that fear that they will close again. So if there was any bonus like that, it would be very much welcomed.
How worried are mums and dads, do you think, about catch up, that kids are now behind in the curriculum?
But that was a big worry that came up socially and academically. So, you know, it depended, particularly certain years obviously suffered an awful lot more. There were formative years that were a little bit difficult. And for children with additional needs, school closures were particularly disproportionately impacted, as were children from disadvantaged backgrounds. But across the board, there are worries about the social impact, the fact that children have got older, but they haven't had the experiences. So perhaps their life experience isn't in keeping with their chronological age, and their social skills haven't increased along with their chronological age because they didn't have those experiences. And then there's the academic side of things, the whole worry. That message was very clear during the second school closures, that the curriculum was continuing, you know, that education was to continue, that there were some online lessons now, the schools were more prepared the second time around, and that the curriculum was to continue. But of course, remote learning didn't suit a huge amount of students. And parents have reported that when they went back to school, while there was support coming from teachers and schools, curriculum had indeed continued and they were moving forward, and parents feel that their children are very far behind. And there are big worries about going back in September, where children are in a new school year. Bear in mind, some of our secondary school students only had 6 weeks in 2021 in school. It was a very short amount of time in school learning, and they're going into September where things will continue as if as normal, they fear, and their children are perhaps not at the stage that they should have been had schools not closed.
Going back to the vaccines for one second, and I'm kind of thinking out loud here, which is a bit of a dangerous thing to do on the radio always, but nobody wants to see mandatory or compulsory vaccination. So I'm just wondering, might there be a gentle trick of persuasion in saying if your child is vaccinated and they end up being a close contact of somebody, they won't have to go home from school, but if they're unvaccinated, I'm afraid that they will?
I think there will, Philip. I think, well, honestly, there actually will. I don't think anybody would be keen to see mandatory vaccination, certainly not amongst the people that I'm speaking to, even those who are getting their children vaccinated.
But do you
themselves.
Think that parents might feel but that they're absolutely. Being tricked or pushed into getting the kids vaccinated if they were resistant?
I mean, I don't think they'll be oblivious to the lure of a vaccine bonus. You know, they are going to see, actually, this will encourage me. But there are adults who have said to me that they got vaccinated because of the digital COVID cert, that was a big appeal to them, that they did that. With children, I suppose the idea is we know they don't get very sick from COVID as a whole. Sorry, there's always be exceptions, but we know, we're being told by the experts that generally children are well. So for parents, they're looking at the bigger picture, you know, they want to protect their children from long COVID, but they also want to protect their children from the impacts of disruption to their education. So if there was a chance that they wouldn't have to, their children wouldn't have to isolate if they were a close contact, or even the masks. Again, the masks, I wouldn't underestimate the concern there is around the masks for secondary school. If it meant that there could be a move towards masks being gone.
Yeah, but we would never have unvaccinated kids.
No, we wouldn't. No, but again, I suppose if there was that whole idea that as the rates increased, perhaps it might be on the table again. It might be something that would encourage a bigger uptake. But I do think parents will see for what it is. But I think parents are looking at vaccination in the bigger picture, really, not just focusing on the illness, but looking at the wider picture too, that protecting their children from illness, but also protecting them from the impacts of school closures and other disruptions to their lives.
Okay. Text on 51551. Our primary school organises a uniform swap day at the end of each year. Old uniforms are given to the school and then organised on tables by age so that parents can drop in on the last day and take what
brilliant
they
idea.
Need. Well done to that headmaster or headmistress. Absolutely brilliant idea. Philip and Jen, my kid's primary school charges us €100 per child, and that covers everything. Book rentals, copies, pencils, insurance, arts and crafts, photocopying, etc. Book rental and all of the administration. That's quite good for €100, isn't it? If they can do it, every school can do it, as we are only an 8-class school. Katrina O'Driscoll in schooluniforms.ie says, I own a school uniform shop and I must disagree with some of the points that you have made. There are no jumpers in our shop that cost €50. Maybe not in schooluniforms.ie. Maybe it's a very, very clever way of advertising with us, but I certainly seen jumpers for 60 quid.
Yeah, me too. I know, that is...
And Aidan in Dublin 3 says, the school books issue is truly shocking and also under climate change aspirations, wholly unconscionable. Mm-hmm. And so say all of us on that one, I'm afraid. All right, Jen Hogan, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Jen Hogan chatting to Philip Boucher-Hayes. Speaking of back to school, unvaccinated pregnant teachers are worried about returning to the classroom in a few weeks' time for the new school year. Pregnant women between 13 and 36 weeks are offered an mRNA vaccine, but teachers in the early weeks of pregnancy are worried about classrooms where large numbers of students are unvaccinated and unmasked. Morning Ireland spoke to Kieran Christie from the ASTI, but first heard from two teachers.
Primary school teacher Sarah is in the early stages of her pregnancy. She won't be fully vaccinated before the new school year. And she explained to our reporter Ailey Sheehy why she doesn't want to return to the workplace.
I was very willing to work remotely and I was happy to do whatever I was asked to do. But unfortunately, that option has been taken away from us teachers and SNAs. And I find that really distressing. We already lost a baby this year. I worked all through that, but I'm not in a position where I'm happy to risk the life of our baby for the sake of a few weeks of school.
And Sarah, have you been speaking to your own consultants and doctors about this?
Yes, my GP and my consultant are both in agreement that I should not be going back to work, particularly when I'm not vaccinated. None of it really adds up, to be honest. It's just frightening that we're getting so close to going back to school and we're in this position, and it doesn't really make sense to me how we were allowed the option to work remotely, but now when things are more dangerous, more contagious, we're not being afforded that option anymore.
That was Sarah, another teacher. Kathy was working remotely throughout May and June after she found out she was pregnant. However, she's now required to return to the classroom when schools reopen. She's been telling us why she doesn't feel comfortable doing so.
I'm quite worried about it. I'll be returning to a situation where in primary school, I'll be in a classroom for 6 hours a day with 30 unvaccinated, unmasked children. There have been no new measures introduced by the department with the new Delta variant, and we know how much more contagious it is since it emerged earlier this year. We know it's been driven down into the younger age categories. So I am quite concerned about this. And because I am high risk, my principal and my board of management are asked to do a workplace COVID pregnancy risk assessment as well. So within that risk assessment, it states that I am to remain 2 metres away from everybody in the school at all times. Now, as a primary school teacher, I'm not really sure how I'm going to be able to do my job very well, remaining 2 metres away from the children in school.
So, Kathy, you're due your second jab shortly and you will have full protection then within 7 days after that. Does this give you some comfort returning to the classroom in September, the fact that you will be fully vaccinated?
Yeah, it does give me some comfort, absolutely. I fully believe in vaccines, but vaccines, as we know, aren't full protection.
Kieran Christie, ASTI General Secretary, good morning.
Good morning, Mary.
Now, we were hearing there from primary school teachers, but are your members who are pregnant or in the early weeks of pregnancy, are they expressing similar concerns to you?
Oh, indeed, they are, absolutely. Pregnant teachers who are in contact with us are incredibly stressed out about the prospect of returning to school in the context, as your two previous contributors said, of the prevalence of the Delta variant. Some of them are losing sleep. They're very upset at night and day and night, indeed. And what should be a wonderful period in their lives is actually somewhat nightmarish. What we've been trying to do is engage with the Department of Education in the first instance and ask them to look at this. And we've repeatedly called on them to look at this again, because it's just not acceptable that pregnant teachers will be coming into school in a couple of weeks' time, each and every one of them terrified from the moment they step in the door to the moment they leave.
Is it clear that the goalposts have shifted somewhat here? I mean, the department's position based on medical advice is that all teachers up to 14 weeks should attend the workplace unless they're categorised as very high risk. But the worry now appears to be not about being unvaccinated or partially vaccinated, but about the prevalence of the Delta variant.
Yeah, the Delta variant is at the heart of the concerns. But even within the cohort of pregnant teachers, there's degrees of discrimination. For instance, I think in your report it was mentioned there that if you're under 14 weeks pregnant, you have not been and you cannot be offered a vaccine because public health advice prohibits it. So these people are going in unvaccinated and had no opportunity to get vaccinated. And the second thing, and it gets worse, the Department of Education issued a circular a few days ago, And it deals with aspects in relation to people who have got significant ailments that put them in what's called the very high risk category. And just to quote, it's an astonishing line in the circular. It says, and these people are pregnant as well. High risk, you must attend the workplace. Now, pregnant women want no risk or low risk in relation to their health and the health of their unborn children.
So what's your advice then to teachers who are pregnant and who are concerned?
Well, we're calling on Minister Foley to have another look at this. We were pleased that even one of the senators in her party, Lisa Chambers, on 5-7 Live yesterday evening, called, for a relook at this. It's just not sustainable. And I'll tell you why it's not sustainable. Because while health advice might be shoring this up to some extent, the minister has a wider duty of care in this situation to those pregnant teachers. It's simply unsustainable that pregnant teachers in the coming weeks going into schools will be doing so in terror and in fear of their health and their lives, of themselves and the worries that they have about the viability of the pregnancies.
Ciarán Christie from the ASTI there on Morning Ireland. Ryan Tubridy spoke to Irish tenor Killian Donnelly about his return to stage in the lead role of the Phantom of the Opera on the West End yesterday.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you?
It's great to talk to you because obviously, you know, I'm a fan of what you do. You're a wonderful singer and a great guy. And to read the reviews in the British press yesterday of your return to the stage as the Phantom in Phantom of the Opera, I was proud Irishman watching another great Irishman.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations. How did it feel to sing the opening bars post-COVID on the stage? Tell me about that experience.
It's incredible. It's absolutely amazing. It's one of those things where I'm going, is this really happening? Am I the Phantom? Or am I just stepping in for someone? And is it the actual real Phantom? Or are we doing it in an amateur production for the weekend? Wow. Those moments hit you all the time. And when it gets me is when I'm in the makeup chair and they're putting on the prosthetics and the whole process takes about 2 hours.
Really?
And I'm just sat there and you slowly just develop into the Phantom. And I've got like Michael Crawford pictures of when he originally played us and when he was getting his makeup process done. They're all plastered around the makeup room. And it's just incredible to be sat in that chair of all the Phantoms who have sat in the chair, including our lovely, wonderful Colin Wilkinson.
Yeah, the great. Well, let's talk about all of this now. You know, so when you're in the makeup chair, getting the armor, as I always say, putting on the suit for Friday night, it's like putting on armor. When they put the final bit of mask that covers half your face on, That must be like, you know, you must feel like Maximus in Gladiator or something.
It is exactly that until you walk down to the stage and you're walking through hallways and you're walking through corridors of rather than the Phantom going up through the rafters or something like that. It's until you're actually on set and you're about to make your first entrance and I'm actually able to see the audience. That's when you sort of embody the character because I don't make an entrance until the first half an hour of the production. So everyone is singing about me.
Yeah.
He's there, the Phantom of the Opera, and it builds the tension. So there's a lot of weight to my first appearance, and when it happens, you can actually hear the audience. That's the thing about the Phantom. He's sort of like a cultural icon. Mm. And even if people haven't seen it, they know that there is something called the Phantom of the Opera. So when they go and see it for the first time, the tension builds and builds and builds with the score, with the overture at the start. So, I don't think it hits me until I'm actually on stage that I go, oh my God, I'm doing the Phantom of the Opera. I'm in the boat. We're singing these songs. It's amazing.
And these songs, these iconic songs. And he's a bit creepy, isn't he? I mean, to say the least. And the reviews were suggesting that you have brought a sort of violent edge to it, you've gone, you know, pretty kind of physical with them.
Well, there is that because the thing about the Phantom is timeless. So it's not a story from 1600s that they made in 1985. It's still relevant today. How it's someone who has never been loved, who has never been accepted, and he doesn't know how to connect with someone. So falls in love. And the moment Christine Daae, played by Lucy, the moment she shows him the smallest bit of interest, he doesn't know how to contain that emotion. So he bashes at times. If she turns her back on him, he grabs her and pulls her in. So there's those moments that we're allowed to explore. Because how would he deal with this? How has he's never held a hand. He's never kissed. So dealing with the affection of how does he deal with that. So it was something that we were trying. We were saying, would he be violent here? Would he be grabby? How would he deal with that? So that was it.
And that's what we'll do. We'll pull Killian down there and say, because the line's just gone, as you can hear, a little choppy. And while we call him back, let's play. This is beautiful. This is Killian singing from Phantom of the Opera as it turns out, this is with the RTE Concert Orchestra at their best, and it really is quite something. And here is the a little piece of that. This is the song that Killian enjoys singing the most on stage as Phantom.
Softly, deftly, music shall caress you. Hear it, feel it. Secretly possess you. Open up your mind. this darkness that you know you cannot fight. The darkness of the music of the night.
Killian, you have some voice.
Thank you very much.
Honest to God, I'm not surprised. Why do you think Andrew Lloyd Webber said to you, has he told you why he said, you are the anointed one, I want you?
he hasn't actually, but I think it's him and Cameron McIntosh that picked their phantoms, and I think it was more Cameron than it was me. But Cameron, because I grew up in Les Mis, like, that was my training, if you will, starting off as a swing. And going up through the ranks, my voice just developed and developed and developed by singing Les Mis and then going across the Phantom. But Andrew has come into the dressing room and he talks about the text all the time. So how the diction is there for a reason in music of the night. It's not to throw away the words, grasp it, sense it.
Fascinating that he's that hands-on, like micromanaging the performance.
I couldn't believe it. I thought you just get the gig and then you barely see them. But I guess it's because it's a reopening of the show. Mm. They're there all the time. Cameron is in every day asking how you are, saying how happy he is with the show. And it was amazing the other day because if ever I speak to Cameron McIntosh, I try and become someone I'm not. I try and become this actor as if I'm saying what he wants to hear.
Mm.
But we're all really tired at the moment because we've been in tech rehearsals from 10 a.m. We rehearse till 5 p.m. and then we do a show that night. And I said to him, why am I so tired? And he turned around and he said, you're not match fit. You haven't been doing this for 18 months. None of us have. So it's building that stamina up again. And that's what you're fighting against. That's what you're going with. So in the last three shows, maybe, I've really felt I've been on top of it again. So, but it took a while to get there. But it's amazing that they're very hands-on that way.
Do you get chauffeur-driven to the theatre every night?
No, I don't.
What?
It's quicker in the train. If I was to get a car, it would probably be about 55 minutes with the traffic. But I go, look, I'll get the train. Or sometimes I cycle. It's very good for your voice to cycle.
Is it?
Yeah. So there's this thing which, if you have a straw in your mouth and you hop on the bike, it regulates your breathing. Now, you look like an idiot, but it really, really helps your breathing.
I'm going to cycle into the toy show next year, this November.
There you go.
With that tip going, don't stop me now. Whatever song.
Please tell me this is work.
And I'll blame you. I'll say, Killian told me this is the thing to do. Without through the straw, that could work a treat.
Killian Donnelly, who's currently starring as the Phantom in The Phantom of the Opera on the West End, chatting to Ryan Tuberty. And it's not just theatres that are slowly reopening. You might be lucky enough to be heading to the cinema this weekend. And Philip Boucher-Hayes in for Claire Byrne had the show's monthly preview of all things entertainment.
Time now for our monthly preview of all things culture and entertainment with Aoife Barry and Brian Redden. Morning, everybody. Let's start with your cinema pick, Aoife. Adam Driver, one of the most compelling actors on screen at the moment. But why is it that all of these actors think that they have to stretch themselves and do something that they know their audiences are going to be uncomfortable with? A musical, Annette.
Well, it depends on how comfortable you are at musicals, I suppose. Yeah, this is called Annette. It's coming out kind of the very start of September, end of August. So this is a kind of getting people to keep their eye out for it and maybe book their tickets in advance, because obviously we know only about a third capacity cinemas at the moment. It comes comes from Leos Carax, who is a French director. People might remember Holy Motors as a film from him a couple of years back. And this has got Marion Cotillard and Adam Driver in it, and they play a love-struck couple. So we get their kind of love affair, but then we also find out they're having
a kid.
That's
kind of refreshing, isn't it? Because she must be about 10 years older than him. For a
change. He's not 65 and she's not 21, which is, you know, a wild move there for Hollywood. And so they're madly in love. She's an opera singer. He is a stand-up comedian. And they have a kid, and then things start to go a little bit weird. But this film is actually a very strange film. It was coming from a concept from the Sparks brothers, the male brothers, who are a really intriguing and great musical act. And it looks really fantastic. It's sung the whole way through. So thinking about something like The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, but gone very, very strange. And this has been getting really interesting reviews. You know, when it was out in Cannes, it got some 5-star reviews and then some other reviews where people were kind of confused about what was going on. So wanted to flag it because I think it could be one of those Marmite films this year, and particularly with such a big cast, people will be dying to see this, and I'm very intrigued to see what people make of it. But I personally am a big fan of Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard, so I'm very interested to see what they do together in this.
Brian, you would think at this age that I would have been scammed by enough trailers in the past not to be taken in by the trailer for Boys from the County Hell, but it looks really, really good. It looks like a lot of fun. This is an Irish horror.
And it is a lot of fun, but it's actually, the trailer kind of is a bit misleading because it's not full of laughs. I mean, there are some good laughs in it, and it is pitched as a comedy horror, but actually it is quite horrific in places as well. There's lots of gore in it. So what's interesting about this goes
right
back.
Were you a little bit scared, Brian?
I was a little bit scared, a little bit. A bit wet, tiny bit. But yeah, there was this goes right back to Bram Stoker's Dracula, right? Because there was a whole school of thought that Bram Stoker did not base Dracula on the legend of Vlad the Impaler, right, in Transylvania. But in fact, it was based on this Irish vampire legend called Abertach, which happened up north near Derry, right? So actually, the whole theory was that in Irish back in those days, this guy would suck the blood from people, and it was called bad blood. In Irish, that's Druk Ulla. Say that fast. Druk Ulla. Dracula. Wow. Dracula.
Why did we never know this before now?
Yeah. So Dracula is actually a Gaelgore. So this is all based on this old myth of Abertach. So Abertach is buried beneath this pile of rocks, and these a bunch of construction workers knock the rocks over. They release the spirit of Abertach, and he goes on this terrible rampage, sucking the blood from the locals. So these guys have to try and stop him. So there's a mixture of kind of really horrific gore, some laughs in it, but at the heart of it is there's a lot of heart on display, both actual hearts and actual heart and emotion. It's a kind of a story. It's kind of a story between a father and a son, and a father and a son trying to bond as well as they try to fight the blood sucking demon. Okay. But it's well worth a watch,
and a very fun looking cast in there as well, including I'm about to forget her name, Louisa from
the Derry Girls.
From Derry Girls,
yes, indeed.
Yep. Okay, if a fan of Schitt's Creek will know who Annie Murphy is, her latest role is that of Alison McRoberts in, I'm not going to say it, are you going to say it?
Well, we can call it Kevin Can F Himself, I think, because that way then it's the name of the show, and it's not me cursing on purpose. But yeah, this show does have a kind of not even a PG name, an adult name. You know, anybody who's watched TV over the last 20 years will know that American sitcom format, you know, thinking about Roseanne, Home Improvement, or say Married with Children, which was itself, I suppose, a satire of that type of genre. This takes that American sitcom where you have the very good looking younger wife, which we kind of talked about earlier, I suppose, and the schlubby older, you know, husband who pokes fun at the wife, at the relationship, and that dynamic that people kind of, you know, accepted as the norm in the sitcom. And it asks the question, what about if the wife is actually really unhappy in this relationship? She really doesn't like Kevin, the husband, to Alison in this series. And what it does to try and get that across is that it's got two different tones to it. So when you're in Kevin's world, you're in the sitcom world. So you've got your, you know, canned laughter. It's quite brightly lit. He's got his friend sitting around drinking beer. And then when you're in Alison's world, it's darker, it's gritty, and she's really wondering, hang on, do I even want to be in this terrible relationship? Do I want to get out of this sitcom world? So it asks questions of the genre, but also of, you know, the people watching it, the audience too, getting really good reviews. It's going to be an Amazon Prime Video from the 27th of August. So that's one people should definitely check out.
Absolutely, that sounds very interesting.
Yeah.
It seems every time, Brian, that I sit here and you sit there, that we end up talking about Gabriel Byrne being in another series, and this month is no different.
Indeed. Indeed, indeed. He's back again in War of the Worlds, in season two of War of the Worlds. Actually, it's interesting because you were talking about The Boys from County Hell, which is based on Dracula, which was written in 1897. War of the Worlds was written in 1898. So here we have two major
But
releases.
There are only four stories, as we know, anyway.
Yeah, it's the gas is going back to the source material that's over 120 years old. So, you know, War of the Worlds, H.G. Wells, how many times has that been made? Endless times. And there's been endless variations of it. But this one is really, really good. This is the second season of it. It's on Amazon Prime at the moment. I'm kind of halfway through the second season. The first season I absolutely adore, but it kind of went under the radar. Not many people knew about it because there was a big BBC period drama adaptation on it, which kind of stole its thunder a little bit, I think. This is a French-American co-production. Gabriel Byrne is in the lead as a scientist.
He's playing Tom Cruise, basically.
Yeah, essentially he's playing Tom Cruise, only he's a scientist trying to figure out why the aliens have come to Earth, you know. Daisy Edgar-Jones from Normal People is really good in it. She plays this woman who has a kind of a link to the aliens, but we're not sure what that link is. It's kind of a telekinetic link. So this is set in the modern day. It's partly in French, it's partly in English. Most of the action takes place either in London or Paris. They must have shot at 3 a.m. in the morning because they got the streets completely empty with dead bodies everywhere. The aliens have come, as they did in the original movie, but where it varies is there aren't the big, you know, aliens that you saw in the Tom Cruise War of the Worlds with the tentacles grabbing people and sucking blood from them. In fact, you never really see the aliens. What they do is they send out these kind of robot drones to kill the people instead. So these kind of robot dogs. It's like an episode of Black Mirror, actually, you know. But it's really interesting and it's really scary. And Gabriel Byrne is actually really, really good in it. And there's a great Irish actor in there who I have to say I'd never heard of before called Aaron Heffernan. He was in Love, Hate.
Yeah, and
he's the standout star of this. He's a young guy. He pops up in the second episode, this really thick dub accent. You're going, where's that coming from? And he's absolutely brilliant in it. So the second season has just landed on Amazon Prime and I would highly recommend it.
Speaking of standout stars, Aisling Bea, Sharon Horgan, that's all that you should really need to hear as a recommendation for This Way Up. But let's just hear a little bit of them.
Okay, so why don't you head out for a bit? Yeah? It's not good for you to be hanging around the house all day, or just with me. Okay?
No.
Well, if you're sticking around, I'm going to Skype Mum, okay? You can have a chat with her.
No, Shona, you're going to threaten me.
I'm not, oh my God, I'm not threatening you.
God, fine, I'll leave this house full of lies and deceit, smoked out like a rat.
Well, look, you have to call her anyway. You haven't talked to her in ages.
Yeah, we can Skype her later when I'm not here.
Oh, my God, you're such a baby. You're a brat.
Well, I texted her last week to see if she was dead.
So?
Ow!
That's not even funny. Don't say that.
Shona, you can't do the same place twice. It's illegal. Bye.
Bye.
Texted her to see if she was dead. Funny stuff, but they deal with some hard-hitting material.
Yeah, it's really hard, I think, to mix, you know, those really funny scenes like you have there where there's kind of that Irish humour and those sisters dynamic as well. I have two sisters, so it's all very familiar to me. And then mixing it with a kind of a tougher subject like you have and This Way Up, you have mental health issues. Aisling Bea's character, Oinne, has spent some time getting some treatment. When we meet her at the start of the first series, she's still dealing with kind of depression and anxiety in the second series, but they do it so well. I mean, it doesn't like shift tonally in any jarring way through this whole thing. You even get lovely stories about things that are happening in London politically, like the Windrush generation and Grenfell as well, that really give you such pause for thought during it and aren't shoehorned in. They're just in there in such a genuine way. And at the same time, you get the story of Aine and Shona, these two sisters living their lives in London, you know, getting on with each other, not getting on with each other and dealing with big things in their lives, but trying to pretend everything's okay. I think that's the big thing that comes out in This Way Up, that idea of trying to get on, but knowing that underneath you're struggling with something. And I just loved this series so much. And you can get it on all four. So all the episodes are there to watch series one and series two.
Okay. We're not going to get to even half of your picks. So I want of what is left on your list, please, Brian, your top recommendation.
OK, this thing is called Schmigadoon and I have to highly recommend it. It is brilliant. It's this mad mix of classical 1940s, 1950s MGM musicals mixed with a team from Saturday Night Live. And it's about a couple who stray into this magical land called Schmigadoon, where the entire inhabitants are trapped in a 1940s musical and they cannot get out until they find true love. So they have to you know, take part in the musical numbers and actually just live the life that they're living there, which is all sweet and all American pie. And they absolutely hate it because they're modern day New Yorkers. But a small little leprechaun played by Martin Short, sure, doesn't he come up to them and tell them they have to find true love or they won't be able to leave this magical land? Now, it sounds terrible. It's hilarious. And the musical numbers are brilliant. It's difficult to get. It's on Apple TV and not everybody has Apple TV, but I would highly recommend it. Lorne Michaels from Saturday Night Live is behind it.
It's directed Saturday by, Night Live. Directed by you Saturday Night Live.
I know, yeah.
I'm out.
I know, it hasn't been good in about 10 years, but it's directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, who did do Men in Black and Get Shorty, so it kind of redeems itself there. But I'd highly recommend it. It's called Schmigadoon.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a hint for something that's on All Four. It's been on it for a good while, but I was absolutely glued to this all week, so I had to mention it. It's called Grey Zone. It stars Birgitta Hjort Sorensen, who people will know from Borgen. She's also been in Game of Thrones. She plays a young mother who works for a Swedish drone company who's taken hostage because the people want her skills to try and basically launch a military warhead on Copenhagen. It's so good.
This doesn't sound like you at all.
Well, I love a bit of Nordic noir, really do. So it's absolutely great stuff, and I would highly recommend people check it out. And there's some great acting in it as well, from one of the characters from Sea Fever, another great Irish film that was out a couple of years ago.
Aoife Barry and Brian Redden there chatting to Philip Boucher-Hayes. Finally, on Friday the 13th, unlucky for some, especially if you're a black cat, the Irish Independent reports today that animal charities have appealed for people to consider adopting black cats, as they're often left behind because people associate them with bad luck. And on the news at one, Justin McCarthy got the lowdown from Gillian Bird from the DSPCA.
Yes, and not just black cats, also things like black dogs or rabbits that are black. A lot of animals that are black often get left behind, usually in preference to other animals that might have white markings on them or brown markings on them that people can often associate with more humanistic sort of facial features. It's quite funny. If you've got a black dog and it's got brown eyebrows, then people will often look at that dog before they'll look at an all black dog.
Is it a superstitious thing, or is it, you know, that perhaps they're not as Instagrammable as other pets?
I think it's more to do with the Instagrammable, and it's the automatic sort of, you look at an animal and instantly, you know, your eye is drawn to the ones that have more interesting colours or, you know, features and things. There may be a bit of the bad luck thing about it, but I think that's not really as much anymore. But definitely, I think it has a lot to do with the markings and appearances. I mean, we always see, you know, the black and white cats with the moustaches being all over Instagram, and, you know, animals like rabbits with funny little faces or eyebrows and things. So I think a lot of it has to do with the markings and the colours.
It's very sad for the old black cats. What do you want people then to do? Do you want people to reconsider their choices here?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you just have to not always be looking for the prettiest animal when you go to the shelter. A lot of it has to do with personality, and whether or not the human personality will match the animal personality. So basically our appeal would be, don't dismiss an animal just because at first appearances it's not as pretty as the animal beside it. Definitely, because it is down to, you know, this is a lifelong companion. You want the personality of the animal to match you and to be a good forever home match, really, at the end of the day.
We've had a lot of people, Gillian, working from home over the past year, and I've seen lots of people out walking their dogs, seen lots of more cats coming into my garden and so on. There's obviously been an increase in the number of people who are taking in pets over the past year. Are you concerned at all that as people return to offices, that those pets may not be getting the care or the attention that they need now?
Yes, I mean, we were obviously very concerned in the early stages, sort of this time last year, of all the people who'd got their pandemic pets. But I think the longer people have these pets, the more they are a member of the family. And obviously, there is always concerns that people aren't going to have the time for the animals when they do go back to work, which is a lot of the reasons why people didn't get pets in the first place. But, you know, hopefully with education and with being able to assist people, and a lot of people are actually getting dog training lessons with their dogs. So hopefully we're going to end up with people who have a more socially balanced animal that is used to being left alone for short periods of time. So hopefully these animals are now more family pets and are less disposable.
Let's hope so. Justin McCarthy chatting to Gillian Bird from the DSPCA on the News at One today. Well, that's it from another edition of Playback Daily. We're back again at the same time on Monday. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and have a great weekend.